So as usual, let's start off with some prayer. So Heavenly Father, we want to praise your mighty name. We want to just come before you with humility and honor you and welcome you to this place. We love you with all of our hearts. Please bless everyone here and protect us. Protect our minds and our hearts as we journey into the Word. Open the eyes of our minds, of our hearts to see what you would have us see and hear what you would have us hear. Protect everyone here and fill us with your word and your wisdom. Protect us and bless our guests as we go forward. Thank you so much for bringing them to us, and we're going to get started. Bless this whole meeting, and thank you for this place and this time together in community. And we pray in Jesus' name. Amen. So, I have a couple things to show you, and the first one is not on the subject that we're on specifically, but it is going to blow your mind. And we have talked about it before a couple times. Do you remember I was talking about the big chart we're working on? I'll show you what this looks like nowadays, because it's a little bit out of hand now. But if you remember this, and I gave you a really, really early version of this, okay? So this is a combination of all the PhD work as well as all the work at Oxford with the archaeology and everything. I call it ATHIS. It's archaeology, theology, history, and interdisciplinary science combination. It is a interlinear, so the things are put side by side. So we have information here concerning Egyptian dynasties, Mesopotamia, Genesis, etc., being cross-referenced. And you remember, we've been doing all this work for quite a few years. Well, remember I had this theory. We're talking about the timing of the Exodus, and we have the journey through the wilderness for 40 years. And because we were able to use the Bible and cross-reference with archaeology, we were able to come up with some really, really solid dates for Moses and the Exodus and everything else. And what that did was place it in a time frame that a lot of people weren't that familiar with. The reason we've already discussed, the reason that people aren't familiar with that, and that was because people took the reference to Ramses' city and ran with it as if it was the time of Ramses. Even though that's not what the text says specifically, the city that they're working on building, the Hebrew slaves, is going to be the city of Ramses. But that's the future, right? So Moses is writing on this side of it. You understand? So what's happening is we've nailed that time down, and we found out Moses was born in about 1526 BC, right? And this is the beginning of the 18th dynasty. All this stuff cross-references when everyone was born, when everything happened. But remember, the reason I'm telling you this is I got to show you something that's going to absolutely blow your mind. We're talking about how the main argument from the academic community against the Exodus is that Egypt ruled Canaan during the time, all the different times that people have talked about the Exodus, which would mean that Moses would escape Egypt into Egypt, which makes no sense, right? So the main argument from academia is, well, this 1446 Exodus, which we have what we call the 15th century Exodus theory, is what we've settled on as the most biblical. And a lot of people, including the editors of the several of the different main study Bibles, that have arrived at the same conclusion. It's not just me or us. It's a very large amount of biblical scholars and academics throughout the world that have arrived at this 15th century Exodus. Anyway, the point of this discussion is he goes from Egypt into Egypt, and how does this work? And so we discovered when we got deeper into who the pharaohs were. And of course, if you watch a lot of cartoons or more simplified children's story versions, it's always the same Pharaoh that's there when he's a kid and then there later on when he comes back and all that. And none of that makes any sense because we're talking about 340s. He's 40 years in the court of Pharaoh. He's 40 years old when he goes out into the wilderness, right, the first time, and becomes a shepherd and everything. Comes back at 80, let my people go. He's 80, okay? These are big periods of time. And to lock them down into a period of time like we've done is very difficult. So this is all kinds of books in the making. All the pharaohs, especially the one who would be his adopted father, Amos the first, all the pharaohs around that period of time have Moses in their name. And so Moses is the name of the pharaoh as well as Moses, right? It's very clear from linguistics with Tutmosa and Amosa and Mosa, or Moses. It's very clear from linguistics that they're connected, that that's a family. So
Moses then is a family name?
Well, here's what happened. If you pulled a baby out of the water, right, and you were the daughter of Pharaoh, and you brought it into Pharaoh's home to be raised as a son of Pharaoh, and the family names all contained Moses... Yeah. Call the kid Moses.
All right.
Now that's totally groundbreaking information. That's not like out there, okay? But the point is that it all makes sense once you nail it down. Okay? So now, why am I telling this story? Well, we all know that Amenhotep the first would be Moses' older brother. And we would also have the knowledge that Amos the first and Amenhotep the first are great, powerful warlords. Okay? They're great generals. So people should ask the question that don't study like this. People should ask the question, well, how does Moses train Joshua? How does Joshua conquer Canaan? How does Joshua have the military chops, the tactical knowledge of military formations to attack settlements that are already established, that already have cities in defensive positions? How can he do that? And the answer is, he's been trained by some of the greatest generals of all time, his father, adopted father, and his adopted brother, older brother, who was Pharaoh when he was there, are both two of the greatest generals in the history of Egypt. Okay? Now, there's a bunch of different pharaohs, because some of them only reigned for a couple years, but he leaves. So the question becomes, when Moses comes back, now we've seen Charlton Heston, okay? We've seen the movie version. But when he comes back, who's on the throne? If it was a relative of his that knew him, that he grew up with, the discussion would be a very different discussion, right? But it's not. In real life, in the actual cross-referencing, the Pharaoh that sits on the throne when he returns to say, let my people go, was born, he was in his late 30s. He was born right after he left. The people alive in power when he returns have never met him. Okay, this is hugely important. Now, the reason I'm opening with this, and I know it's completely off the subject, but I discovered something that just God floored me. Okay, it was one of those, you know, God smacks. So here's how it works. We talked about Tutmosa the third, who was in charge when Moses came back. He's the third Tutmosa. He's born right after he leaves, so he doesn't know him. He's in charge when he gets back. He's got a point to prove because this Pharaoh has a major chip on his shoulder. The Pharaoh of the Exodus, Tutmosa the third, has a major chip on his shoulder. First of all, his mother, Hatshepsut, was sort of a very domineering, very controlling person. She was one of the female pharaohs, which are very rare. And she dealt very harshly with people. He actually went and chiseled off her face from most of the monuments. He's in his 30s. He's got fathers and grandfathers that are legendary generals. Okay? So he's got a chip on his shoulder. So it's very easy to see why his heart was so hard. Why he was like, I don't care who you are, I'm not letting these people go, I got an empire to build. Right? It's very easy to see. Now, when Moses leaves with the people after, and we discovered, by the way, that Tutmosis' first son did not ascend the throne. In the Egyptian record by atheist Egyptologist, Tutmosis III's son, his firstborn son, died mysteriously. In the Egyptology record. So that is the last plague. His son really did die. And so a nephew or another son who took the name Amenhotep II assumed the throne. Amenhotep II has a really big chip on his shoulder because he's named after Amenhotep I, who's one of the greatest generals in the history of Egypt. What's the point? The point is, if Moses goes out with all these Israelites and they go out into the desert, and this guy's dad gets the main troops get drowned and everything, and he's just dejected and defunct for several years and then dies because he's lost his firstborn son, he's lost most of his troops and some of his generals in the Red Sea. So they're off there wondering. The first thing Amenhotep,
excuse me, what means ship on the shoulder?
Yeah, it means like you have something to prove. You're angry, you have a hurt heart, you have a grudge, you have something to prove, okay? He's got something to prove, okay? And so Amenhotep II, what is he going to do? Well, he's going to immediately go and get he would immediately go and find those guys and bring them back. Or kill them or whatever. But he's got his handful because the little hiccup that happened after they lost all those guys in the Red Sea, that little hiccup caused trouble in their empire. So, bringing it full circle, the reason that the scholars have a problem with the Exodus is that they were battling in the Holy Land, which is called the Levant, okay, by people who study this area, this region, archaeologists, anthropologists. Within the Levant, which was owned by Egypt at the time of the Exodus, they had battles. So this doesn't make sense to a scholar who knows that Amenhotep II is going to invade the Holy Land and be scouring it and be fighting the Mitanni, which are up in Syria, fighting the Mitanni all through the Holy Land. How are these guys that are wandering around, hundreds of thousands or whatever, wandering around the desert, how are they not just rounded up or killed? And remember how we had a theory that we bet that God, who's sovereign and in charge, has led them zigzagging away. And what's happening is they're going fighting here, and they're going over here, and then they're going fighting over here, and they're going over there. And the reason for the 40 years is not just what is commonly believed, like, you know, a punishment or whatever. Commonly, it's believed that the 40 years is all about the quality of the people. In other words, you had slaves coming out of Egypt, but you need an army. And an army does not have a slave mentality. If you raised an entire generation in the desert, they would be hardened. You train them their whole lives. Now, you've got an army. 40 years later, you have an army of people born in the wilderness and trained and hard, and they're ready to go take Jericho and all of Canaan. That's a really good thing. That's the point. But here's another point from this cross-referencing. The people in charge for the 40 years are highly motivated military pharaohs. If Joshua invades 5 years or 10 years after, if Moses and Joshua invaded 10 years after they left Egypt, a letter would arrive in Egypt from the person that's holding that citadel in the Levant, and they would dispatch an army and destroy the Israelites. Okay? But that didn't happen. 40 years went by. So who's in charge when they finally cross over and attack Jericho? Well, the person that's in charge then is Tutmosis IV. Why does that matter? Because Tutmosis IV gets himself a Mitanni queen and declares that entire region a neutral zone and turns around and goes and deals with Africa, specifically Nubia. So he is now ignoring the entire region. The Mitanni Empire is ignoring the entire region. The Egyptians are ignoring the entire region. Joshua walks in, starting with Jericho, and they spread out through Canaan.
Where was Mitanni? Where was it?
Syria.
Assyria?
Yes, Syria. So, This is what the 40 years is about. But remember, we had a theory. If that's true, then we should be able to cross-reference a map of the Exodus travels through the desert and a map of Amenhotep's campaigns, and they shouldn't cross. Are you with me? If that's true, then God is greater than we even dreamed, which we already knew he was great, and the world is about to change when someone puts that in a book. All right, are you ready? So here's what we found out. So this is the Exodus map. This is a basic one, okay? This is them coming out of the city of Ramses, which is in Goshen. It could be a little bit up here. They're coming down. Mount Sinai's down here. So they're traveling down here. They're coming up around. They camp here. They do a little thing through Kadesh and Mount Hor. They come down here. This is the scary part for people, because they've heard about battles from Egyptian pharaohs in Kadesh. And they're like, well, this is bad, because these guys would have been toast, right? What they're referring to is Ramses' battle in Kadesh, not Amenhotep. Okay, we'll get back to this. Here's another map, right? There's the Ramses city going down here to Mount Sinai, up through here, wandering around. So you see, all right, I'll blow this up for y'all. You see this map? You see, they come out of Egypt. They're crossing here. See where they cross? So when they come out of Egypt, they head immediately due south. They cross over. They keep going south through all of these places. The wilderness of Sin, Elim, Moriah, right? All these places down here to the Sinai wilderness where the mountain is. And then there's your mountain right there. Then they're going to come up here camping out. They're going to go around and come through here. Okay, so we've got a couple maps. We've got a couple maps of this. All right, I'm going to get back to that. So, that's the general map. You ready? Here we go. This is the map of the Amenhotep II campaign. This is where he fought. You see? He comes out, goes up the coast. This is very common because this is the main coast road. The main road through these regions, the highway, the king's highway, if you will, the pharaoh's highway, runs up and down through here. It'll go out. There'll be a break off to Damascus. It'll go through here like this. And you'll see Jerusalem, Hebron, all those places, and the entire Sinai Peninsula are here. So what God did was send those guys out and south, and then keep them in the south. And Amenhotep charges over. What's he thinking? What's Amenhotep thinking? Amenhotep's thinking Fertile Crescent. He's thinking you've got to stick to where the water and the crops are, especially if you have 100,000 people. If you have a couple hundred thousand people, you've got to go through the Fertile Crescent. The Fertile Crescent runs from the Egyptian Nile Valley up through the Holy Land, arcing around through the rest of it, right? So I'll get to a bigger map. So you see this? So this is the Tigris and Euphrates River, right? This is the Fertile Crescent, the green. So what you had to do was you had to come out of Egypt. You had to go this way through the green. You go around, see Abraham? Abraham starts down here in Ur of the Chaldees, goes up through here, right? Gets up here to Haran. Remember, this is Paddan Aram we've been talking about for all these chapters we've been in Genesis, coming down through here. And going in, Abraham and Isaac and Joseph and Jacob, everybody follows the Fertile Crescent. So what does Amenhotep think of hundreds of thousands of people have to do? They do. Because the only way for them to not follow the Fertile Crescent and to go out into the desert and live would be what? Pop quiz. What's the only way to live?
With the help of God.
With the help of God. The only way to live is going to be manna. Without manna, without not hitting rocks and water coming out, there is no survival. So you can see where they went, which is in wilderness, all of it. Horrifying desert wilderness. He would never look for them there. Not only that, but he had to secure, right? He had to secure all of his holdings. And his holdings, the ones that make money for Egypt, are where the red and green lines are.
Did he look for the Israelites?
We don't know historically if he did, but if he did, he would have expected them to go this way.
Yeah.
First of all, the history. So all the patriarchs were talking about, if he knew, and he probably didn't, but if he knew about Abraham or about Jacob or about where Joseph came from, any of that, he probably didn't because it's been a long time. Okay, but if he did know about him, he knows they come from there. What does he know probably? Well, he knows that the people of Canaan have come and gone from Egypt many times. And I'm not talking about just the patriarchs. I'm talking about thousands of people from Canaan have come and gone from Egypt. That's the whole thing. That's why Abraham did it. That's why even when Jesus was being hunted, when he was a baby, they went down into Egypt. This is a standard procedure. Go to Egypt because Egypt's always prosperous. The Nile is like clockwork. It's always flooding. There's always fresh silt. It's beautiful. Go to Egypt. So this is the road. This is where everybody travels. That travels from the Turkey area, travels from the Damascus area, travels from Mitanni, right? They all go through Canaan, but they hug the coast because that's where everything is fruitful. That's where all the food is. That's where all the grapes and olives are. That's where all the lush land is. You start traveling south or west, you hit desert and harsh wilderness. So what we have is the archaeological, anthropological, historical data tracking Amenhotep's campaigns and the data tracking the wilderness journey of Exodus, and we can see plainly and clearly that they miss each other the whole time. And look where he comes in. Just imagine this. So we come here. He comes, does this zigzag, and this is when he crosses over and attacks Jericho right here. So this is 40 years later, right? This is where, you know, Abraham's looked on the land and passed away. Joshua's in charge. The crossover. Look where they attack. They don't attack coming out of Egypt. They don't attack coming north from the desert. They've worked around all the way through this, and now they're attacking Jericho. This kingdom's already fallen by now. Basically, those guys are on the outs. This whole area is a neutral zone. And they're so far away from the powers that be. Even if Tutmosis IV cared about some ragtag Israelite army invading the Holy Land, which he does not. Okay? But even if he did, you're like, okay, smarty pants, what about when he died and his son took over and they knew there was an attack going on? Because by 1200, the Egyptians are talking about Israel. Okay? So what happened? You know, why didn't his son go, okay, well, I'm going to go help those guys and reestablish this and I'm going to kill the fledgling, you know, the guys that maybe had the judges, and they were scattered around in little encampments and little towns. Let's go kill them off. Why didn't his son do that? Well, his son's another Pharaoh, okay, who you may know the name of, and you may not, but you can see after Tutmosis IV, we get Amenhotep III, known as the Magnificent King. Why? Because he built monuments. His thing was architecture and monuments. He didn't fight wars. He built monuments. And you're like, okay, smarty pants, how about the next guy? Surely somebody, during this whole long thing where the Israelites are invading Canaan and taking out Egyptian outposts, essentially, Canaan outposts of Egypt, and they're taking these guys out right and left, and those guys are writing letters, please help us, please help us, which we have found those letters. The Amarna letters contain letters from the guys in Canaan begging for Egyptian help. They get ignored. Why? Well, first guy has a queen in Mitanni, doesn't care, he's fighting in Nubia. Second guy, the magnificent king, building nothing but monuments to himself. Okay, the third guy on the list, Akhenaten. Now, I don't know if you know who that is. I know Andy does. Akhenaten is the guy who tried to change Egypt into a monotheistic religion. His entire life and his wife Nefertiti, who's famous, you guys have heard of her, Akhenaten's entire life was based around trying to revolutionize the religion of Egypt into a monotheistic religion where they worship the Akhen, or the Aten, which is, of course, the sun, which I find to be quite ironic. But it's not the real sun. They're way past sun worshipers. So if it's not the sun as in the sun, but it's the sun, which sun is it? Anyway, the point is, there's been about 5,000 books written about what his point was, monotheism and the sun. But the point is that he didn't do that either. And what happens after that? Well, what happens after that is that that dynasty begins to fall. Okay? So, we have time to set up. Check this out. We'll go back. So there he is, right? Akhenaten. These guys are trying to survive. See how long they reign? 1 year? 2 years? We finally get to this guy. Anybody recognize Tutankhamun, King Tut? He's a kid. He's a kid, right? So he can't do anything about anything. And then what? One more guy, and we're out. That's the end of the dynasty. Okay? Now we're going to have a break, and then we're going to start. We're going to be in the 13th century, and we're going to start with the Ramesses dynasty, and that's going to be a big deal in Egypt. But by then, what has happened? By then, that we're established in the Holy Land. By then, it's been hundreds of years, and the Holy Land's established. By then, Saul's beginning to talk about being king. David's out there, you know, practicing with his slingshot. Right? You get it? It's traceable archaeologically. Not in the minds of the majority of the world, okay? Because there's a lot of confusion, okay? But if you put this chart together and put it all side by side, you can tell that they have time to develop. So what's going to happen is you're going to begin to see from both sides, from the Assyrian side and the Babylonian Assyrian side and from the Egyptian side, you're going to see the mention of Israel. And you're going to see the mention of King David. And it's going to start after this period of time. So we've given them time to establish. So I know that's not on the subject we're on, but when I got those two maps side by side, I was like, oh my goodness. I'm going to have to show everybody this right now. So I had to show everybody that. So sorry for the little side break, but it's a big one. Okay, so let's go back to what we've been actually studying.
Well, it is a big one, and that's what you're saying, because if history, archaeological history, doesn't agree with the Bible, we got a problem.
Right.
But it does agree.
It does, and that's so, the thing, the biggest mission of my life. There's lots of missions, and God does what He wants, but the biggest mission of my life is to get people to understand that there is no conflict or battle between science and religion. There is none. Everybody's become convinced primarily because of just a few power figures with a chip on their shoulder, okay? Just a few guys with an agenda have pushed it so hard on both sides that the majority of the populace has become convinced that there's a battle raging, that science and Christianity are at odds, that the Bible is full of fairy tales and science totally doesn't agree, and it's all this horrible miscommunication. And that's simply not true. We've seen this since the very first line of the very first verse of the very first chapter of Genesis. We started in January, and we started with Genesis 1 and advanced astrophysics. And we went through the entire concept that advanced physics, not regular physics, but graduate level astrophysics, matches Genesis perfectly. And so does biological science, even though the main leader of the atheist anti-Bible movement is a biological scientist himself, believing that there is absolutely no connection between the two. And we've seen, because of the original languages, if you look at English, it becomes very difficult, right? English, the Bible was not written in English. And everybody thinks, you know, Jesus probably spoke English, I think with a southern accent, I'm pretty sure. He had a southern accent.
Amen.
But he was like, come here, John. No. John, this is your mother. Your mother, this is your son. No, that wasn't what happened. They were not speaking. There's no English speakers anywhere in the Bible or near the Bible. Okay.
Going to Texas on vacation.
Now that's isn't that where it took place? There's a big wilderness
Texas
in Texas.
Is Israel, I think.
They left El Paso and showed up in Dallas. Is that what happened?
That's right.
There's a star. There's a star in Dallas. I'm just saying.
That's for sure.
I'm just saying. There's a star in Dallas. It's on helmets.
As we say in Texas, them there cowboys.
So anyway, the point is that one of our themes, and it's quite from God and the Holy Spirit. It's not from me personally. It's been led for the last several decades. God's been leading me this way. But the when I first prayed about this, I was very scientifically, educationally minded. And I was also very, very spiritual and wanted to be very holy and everything. And I was praying because I was being told all these battles were going on. Mm-hmm. And the message that God gave me over and over again for over a decade was, there is no conflict. There is no battle. It's all being made up. Men are fighting, but there is no battle. In my universe, there is no conflict. And he told me this over and over and over again. And over the last decade or two, we've managed to pull together these pieces, as you see, piece by piece, which led all the way through a PhD and all the way to the Archaeology Department of Oxford, where I'm at currently, right? And so that's a blast, by the way. Being the only Christian in an entire department is a blast. But anyway, I'm just kidding. That's called sarcasm. Anyway, the point is that there is no conflict. Every single time we dig something up, it matches. So there's a new archaeological find near the coast in the Holy Land that's called Ascalon. And it's a Philistine burial site. And they've got a bunch of buried Philistine stuff. In the buried Philistine stuff, and the Philistines have been cross-referenced with Egypt. There's some paintings of them on some things in Egypt. They've been cross-referenced. They existed. Everybody knows that. But everybody's arguing not about the Philistines existing, but they're arguing about David and Solomon existing. But then a big tablet shows up that says the house of David on it. And they're like, okay, well, I guess there was a house of David, but maybe it was just a little tiny thing in like a village somewhere. There's always this argument going on. And what when we do this thing here, one of the subjects, and some of you guys, it's going to be old news. Now, everyone else that's there, it's going to be relatively new. But a lot of you guys have heard some of it before. But they're digging up all this physical material about these Philistines. Thank you so much. And the physical material that they're digging up, it matches the Bible description perfectly. They've never had a Philistine site before. Everything that's been known about Philistines has been conjecture or biblical or off the wall in Egypt, but nothing has been physically found until recently. And the Philistines were on the bridge between the Bronze Age and the Iron Age. And in the Bible, it describes Goliath having a giant spear with a really big iron tip. And a big circular shield. He had a shield bearer. And bronze javelins on his back. Bronze javelin on his back. So how he would open up this battle is, the guy would get in front of him with the shield. He would hit you with a javelin or two, right? And then he would pick the shield up and pull out his giant spear and fight you in much the same way as the Spartans fought. Because the Philistines came from the Aegean Sea. And there's only 600 years separation between that and the height of the Spartans. So they're proto Spartans, basically, right? Plus, it's a giant anyway. But the point is that all that stuff's been found. They found bronze javelins. They found steel tips in the same grave areas, which matches the Bible perfectly, and the time frame perfectly. So all this stuff is cross-referenced perfectly, but the problem is no one knows that. And the reason they don't know that is because the masters of the fields like anthropology and archaeology are not Christians. And the masters of Christianity, the theologians and the lead pastors of megachurches and all those guys, they're too busy doing that. These guys are too busy doing that. And there's not enough time to do both. And that's the problem. So anyway, moving on. But anyway, I just wanted to tell you guys all that stuff. That'll be when I need to go to a site. I'm trying to get on the crew for that dig in Ascalon. So we'll see if I can go to that site. We'll see. Who knows? It's up to God. Anyway, so we've been looking at some of these maps, and I want to show you this one. This is probably one of the better ones. This shows in red Abraham. Okay. And then you see Isaac doesn't do much. Remember how we talked about how Isaac didn't do a whole lot? He kind of stays here. Okay. And then we went through the whole discussion of Jacob getting his birthright. And then they, as you know, they send him away. They send him to Haran, to Padam Aram. They send him up here to go get his wife, which he does, right? So we had the first guy went to get a wife for Isaac up here. But Abraham sent an emissary. Remember the guy with the camels sent the guy up here to get Rebecca. Okay, so we go through all that, but then we have so we get a wife for Isaac like that by an emissary. So Isaac doesn't leave. Then Jacob gets the birthright. We talked about all that stuff and what he did. And then his brother wants to kill him, so he leaves. And he goes back up here, and he ends up spending a long time there. His little short trip turned out to be a really long time. And he's, 20 years or whatever up here. And then he's going to make his way back. And you remember, as we picked up the last couple classes, he had been heading back. And so we'll pick up right here. And you'll see that after returning... Okay, this is for tonight. Okay, let me go one more over. It's my wife, sorry. Here we go. We'll do this one real quick. So you see, he's fleeing from... Okay, so up here is Padam Aram, okay, and Haran. Remember, he flees, and he sneaks out. Remember, he's done all this stuff with his wives. He's got four wives, basically. He's got two official wives and two handmaidens and 11 kids, okay? He's building the future Israel, okay? And he flees, remember, and he comes this way. When he gets down here, and remember what it says, in the mountainous area of Gilead, in the hill country of Gilead, he's overtaken by Laban, remember? So Laban overtakes him in the hill country of Gilead, which is here. That's when they make their deal. That's when they do their covenant and put up their like border or whatever. So now he's gone, and the red line here is his brother. Okay? So we know that Esau, has settled down here. Okay? So this is the site of Mount Seif, okay, where Edom is. And this is the place that Esau lives. So Esau makes a beeline, hearing his brothers coming in. And this is the area right here where the last couple classes have taken place, right? This is where he ends up alone, ends up wrestling with God, right? This is where his name gets changed to Israel. And this is where he meets with his brother. And you can see Mahanaim is there. That's God's place, right? The river's here. You can see all the stuff that we've been discussing. There's Sukkoth. And remember, when we last left off, okay, Esau said, "You've got to come home with me. Come on down. It's all good. I love you, bro. Everything's cool." And he takes off headed south. And we know from what we read in the last few classes in the scripture that he doesn't follow him. He says he's going to, but then he breaks off. And he breaks off this way towards Shechem. And we know why. And the reason is, if he would have followed him down south, he would have become an Edomite. He would have ended up in the wrong place. His kids would have grown up in the wrong place. He's headed into the land that God has promised the people. He is the son of promise. Just like his father, Abraham has a deal with God. It gets passed on to Isaac. It gets passed on to Jacob. And this deal is Canaan, the Holy Land. So he goes into Canaan like he's supposed to. That's the will of God. That's where he's supposed to be. And he lets his brother head on down south again. He's doing a whole different deal. Remember, he married a bunch of women that weren't from the tribes, and they weren't the right type of... He's doing his whole thing. He's making a whole world for himself, and none of it's the Holy Land. None of it's the right thing. So as we pick up tonight, he's traveled up here. And remember how he bought some land and set up camp near Shechem. Okay. Now, just to keep you in track, and the reason I have all these maps, is this is Beersheba down here. This is where Isaac is. This is where he left and traveled all that way north to go to Haran. Okay. This is where Bethlehem is. This is where Jerusalem is. This is where Hebron is. This is all the places that we've seen. This is where he built the altar, where Bethel is. Okay. So that's where the covenant got reconfirmed. So all this stuff we've been studying. Now he's on his way back, but right now we're near Shechem. Now the reason that's important is because of what we're going to study tonight. And that's going to bring us into this map. Okay. After returning from Paddan Aram, Jacob bought some land near Shechem and set up camp. And that's Genesis 33, and that's exactly what we were looking at last time. So we'll go back to that, and we'll move into Genesis 34, and we'll see what happens. So we've already been through 32 when Esau came to meet him. Then he went over to Shechem. That's how that ended. He wrestled with God, etc. Then that was, we went through 33, and he erected an altar there. He came into Canaan to Shechem, got some land, and set up shop. And now we travel into Genesis 34 tonight, and I'm in the New King James Version as usual, but like I said, there's a lot of really great versions. They're all identical almost when it comes to the meaning, so just stick with it. And we'll take a look at what happens. This is the Dinah incident. Okay, this is the story of Dinah. Now Dinah, the daughter of Leah, whom she had born to Jacob. Remember, there's some female children as well, right? Went out to see the daughters of the land. And when Shechem, the son of Hamor the Hivite, prince of the country, saw her, he took her and lay with her and violated her. His soul was strongly attracted to Dinah, the daughter of Jacob, and he loved the young woman and spoke kindly to the young woman. So Shechem spoke to his father Hamor, saying, "Get me this young woman as a wife." Now, I don't know how they do things in Shechem, but that's not the way this is supposed to go, okay? Now, we've discussed this, and like we've said before, we don't know why there is this bizarre, unnatural attractiveness for these people. We've been tracking this for all of Genesis. We call it the remnants of Eden, okay? But you remember how every time they would go somewhere, they would say, "Oh, this is my sister," because everybody wanted to get with those girls so bad, right? Even when they're 90, by the way, they have to lie about it when they're 90, because they're still so attractive and so overwhelmingly attractive when they're 90 that some Pharaoh might grab them and make them. And that's crazy, right? So what is the point of it all? And we don't know. We don't know biblically what the answer is. But just imagine, for sake of argument, just imagine that the people of Eden, Adam and Eve, they were made to be perfect. And they were made to be immortal. They were never going to get sick. They were never going to die. They messed up. They got thrown out. And this whole thing started. Okay? And we have their son, Seth. And we follow his line down through Noah. And Noah, who is a child of this line, is the only really holy man on the world. So he's picked to build the ark and all this and save the people and all of that. Okay? And then we go from Noah down in through the guys to Abraham, and he's the great guy that's chosen by God to be the forefather of the church. As a matter of fact, three religions come from Abraham, and all these things are unique and biblical. But then there's all this the tribes as they develop coming out of Abraham. You'll see a person that'll be a person by name become a town or a region. Like Haran's a guy, and then it's a town, and then it's a whole a region. And if something's going on. They're very, very powerful. And we watch people like Abraham set up shop, and everywhere around him, the guys are giving him homage. They're basically in awe of him for some reason. Even though he's a guy with a bunch of sheep and some tents, the guys with the walled cities don't mess with him. And then we see them kidnap Lot, And Abraham goes after four kings and kills them all with all their armies.
360.
Yeah, with a couple guys, like some, you know, the cook and a couple like butlers. And they go kill those guys. So, you know, it says servants, right? So, I mean, they're probably trained military. But the point is, something weird is going on with these people. We don't know if they're extra tall or if they glow. We don't know what's really going on. But when the girls get in front of like random guys, the random guy like the Pharaoh or whoever, the king of Sodom, and that they go crazy. And they've got to have them. And so you got to lie about it. That's my sister. Leave her alone. And there's proof of that whole thing. In the archaeological record, they found some contracts where guys made their wives their sisters so that they had more power. Anyway, the point is that here we go again.
You're definitely a guy's sister.
Yeah, here we go again.